Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Pretty good.
Well, it seems there's a great hubbub.
We do have a hubbub, don't we? We have a hub and a bub. It is the full, the whole Megillah, as it were.
There's a great hubbub about look, we talk about humane methods of animal husbandry all the time. We talk about, you know, not taking chickens as most of your McNugget chickens are taken and de-beaking them and
tail docking is
all kinds of
nasty cutting
things.
An animal's tail off so that they because they live in such close confines that they won't bite each other's tails off.
But it's so hard to be reasonable and in the middle. Because on the other side...
I think most people would say we're not reasonable and in the middle. Most people would
say we're to the left.
We're way to the left as far as these issues go.
Well, they're wrong. But more to the left, and case in point, more to the left of we are all these nut jobs who have a problem with foie gras that we've talked about a lot. Foie gras is the fattened liver of a duck. It's very natural.
Let me see. So if you're more to the left of us, then you're a nut job.
And if you're more to the right, you're an idiot. You got it. So, but... It's more to the left than we. There's the whole foie gras activism, which is like in the world of where animals are treated humanely or cruelly, foie gras ducks are on the way treated pretty well side.
And we've talked about foie gras ducks, but now
we've gone even further.
This group is just pushing the envelope to points that I think are actually insane.
And Whole Foods is a company we respect and admire and shop in and patronize and enjoy.
It's a shame that they've lost their minds.
It's a shame that they've lost their minds and succumbed to these toadies who, what they've decided to stop doing at Whole Foods is they're no longer going to carry live lobsters at Whole Foods.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to know why?
Why, Francis?
Because they feel that, boiling lobsters is inhumane. That keeping lobsters in tanks is inhumane. They're lobsters. They're the bugs of the sea.
And they're not human.
You know what? It's just crazy to say that keeping a lobster in a tank and then boiling it is inhumane. And by the way,
okay, anybody got a fish tank? Anybody have a fish tank at home? Okay, why is it okay to put fish in a fish tank, but it's not okay to put lobsters in a fish tank?
In a lobster tank.
I don't understand that. Go ahead, move on.
This raises a whole lot of ethical dilemmas, and Michael Pollan is a writer for the New York Times who we're going to have on in a couple of weeks, and he's written a book called Omnivore's Dilemma, which is a really interesting piece about how you want to buy things that are responsible, you want to support local agriculture, and you want to say, yeah, I don't think you should cut the tail off my cow, or it should live its life in a concrete feces-laden feedlot, but by the same token, if you want to put a lobster in a tank, that's okay.
Right.
You know, I mean, we need to make choices. But this is just so dumb because the way – and I think Whole Foods – I think you should all call Whole Foods and tell them you think they're dumb and they should carry live lobsters again. Because one of the things that this does is it takes people – it takes legitimate arguments against ways that animals are being treated very cruelly. And it allows the people who want to continue to do that to throw us all into the same boat and say, oh, you're a bunch of whack jobs on the left.
Well, you know, and there's also this whole argument about, there are two arguments here. The first is that they're kept in lobster tanks. Okay, fish are kept in fish tanks. You go to a pet store, they're kept in fish tanks. You go to somebody, your friend's house, and he's got an aquarium. You go to the aquarium in Camden, and there are fish kept in tanks. Okay, so I say bogus argument. Second argument. Is, okay, well, they die a painful death when you put them in boiling water. First of all, most people say that the lobsters don't feel it. Okay, but okay, let's.
And most restaurants don't kill lobsters that way anymore. And
exactly.
And what you should do at home, we find, to make it easier and neater, is you just take a knife and you go through the lobster head, and the lobster's dead.
And you cut the lobster head right in half, and the lobster's dead instantly, and that's it.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And why that's any different than any other animal, spider that you might squish with your foot. Why is it different than
let
that?
Let me read from the Frank Bruni article in the Times when he talks about, you know, once you start talking about this stuff, where does it end? Do oysters have little bivalve souls? Do they dream briny dreams? Scream briny screams? And that's where, I mean, look, yeah. When you go fishing, you catch a fish. That poor fish is on the end of a hook for a long time until you bring it in.
Have you seen, and I've seen a documentary where a wolf fish eats a lobster. Have you seen what a wolf fish does to a lobster underwater?
The lobster gets to watch itself being
eaten. Not as nice as putting a little knife through its head and instantaneously being dead, okay? It's not like that.
You know, I think that one of the things that happens is, I think that what needs to happen to have a moral sensibility is, if you were on a farm, or if you grew up on a farm, or if you were anywhere near a farm and you knew how food was produced, you would say, foie gras ducks, that's sort of natural. You know, raising a cow in the field and slaughtering it very quickly, that's sort of natural. Catching a fish on a line, killing it immediately and cooking it, that's kind of natural. Cutting the cow's tail off, not so natural. Cutting the chicken's beak off,
not so natural. And making it live in a cage where it's actually pressed against another chicken or another
for
cow
its whole life and
or
never
another
touched
pig. Okay,
what both of these positions speak of, the position that says, I don't care how the chicken was treated, all I know of chicken is it comes in a package, and the position that says, oh, no, you're going to kill a chicken, you might hurt it.
Right.
Both of those come from someone who is so far removed from the production, from the actual means of growing food and making food, that, you know, it's animals in the wild say, oh, how could you possibly eat a rabbit?
Right.
Or how could you kill a rabbit? Listen, rabbits don't retire to Florida and die in their sleep surrounded by their family. If you don't eat the rabbit, an owl is going to eat the rabbit while the rabbit watches.
Right.
You know, and it's not going to, like, stun it before it does it. You know, I mean,
There's no electricity in nature.
There's a reasonableness. I have to say, there's one crazy thing that was also reported in the paper. They have come up with a machine that is the humane lobster killer. It's a tool for humanely killing lobsters and crabs by electrocuting them.
Okay, I got a tool for humanely killing lobsters and crabs. It's called a knife.
Why is electrocuting them more humane? Anyway, the thing costs $4,000.
$4,000 for the single-use one. There's another one that's for mass production.
$78,000.
$78,000 lobster killer. I'll give you one for $1.50.
So if you're at all interested, we'll put that up on our website, and you should tune in next week when we have Michael Pollan on the show to talk about Omnivore's Dilemma, and we'll deal at length with this issue. We have Evan Goldstein coming up after the break. He is a master sommelier, one of the seventh master sommelier in the country, and he's going to talk about food and wine pairings, an interesting topic. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey, 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. In 1987, Evan Goldstein became the eighth American and the youngest ever master sommelier at the time. He teaches professionals and consumers about wine and food. He's the author of Five Star Service, Your Guide to Hospitality Excellence, and his new book is Perfect Pairings, a Master Sommelier's Practical Advice for Partnering Wine with Food.
Evan, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm terrific this morning, and thank you so much for having me.
Love your book.
I really appreciate that. Thanks a lot. It's a labor of love and something that I believe really resonates with everybody out there, whether you happen to be in the business or you're just an Epicurean, passionate consumer.
Well, you know, it's funny. Mark and I have been doing this for 14 or 16 years as well, and we've been teaching consumer classes. And
who says 14 or 16 years?
Well, 14 years on our own and 2 years for somebody else. But one of the topics in all the consumer classes that we teach that I find is the hardest to really give anybody rules for, because it's really sort of a slippery and amorphous subject area, is pairing wine and food. There are a lot of wine and food books on wine and food pairing out there that after I read them, I'm a little more confused than when I began. How do you think your book's different?
I concur with that, and it's certainly a subject that piques the interest of everybody out there because we all love to eat our food and enjoy our wine. It was interesting when we started the sort of journey itself, and like you, I've been talking about wine and food for a long time, and it does excite people but also confuse them. My sort of look into the world of wine and food books that were out there essentially showed that there were kind of two polar directions that they had gone. One style of books tended to be these sort of very physically heavy tomes that were sort of everything you ever possibly wanted to know about wine and food, and by the time you got to page 7, you'd sort of scratch your head, I think, as you alluded to, and say, geez, I really just wanted to know what to have with my Chardonnay.
Right.
While the other style of books that were out there were the sort of kind of empowering books that came out of sort of the initial interest in food and wine that told people, look, if you really enjoy hamburgers and you want to have late harvest Riesling or Sauternes with it, who are we to tell you that you're wrong? Wine and food is very subjective, blah, 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 which, you know, comes off, frankly, as flip. And I wanted to find that sort of sweet spot in between that gave people sort of some very practical tools, and hence the use of the word practical in the title, but that also provided some good education and made it approachable for everybody, whether you were really wine knowledgeable or not, whether you were super food knowledgeable before reading the book or not.
I just so everyone knows what the book is about, again, it's called Perfect Pairings. It's by Evan Goldstein. It just came out. We'll link you to it on our website. And the book is very interesting. It has 58 recipes developed by Joyce Goldstein, who's your mom, right?
Correct. Uh-huh.
It takes us through 12 grape varieties, and it puts these recipes together with wines and tells you why they sort of work and what you should look out for and gives you some suggestions onto producers. But I got the feeling when I read this book that it wasn't that you were necessarily saying make this recipe and have this wine and here are the pairing, here are the 58 pairings you can do. But it was more like when you put these two together, you're sort of teaching people like the principles of how to put wine and food together going forward. Was that your intention?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, the whole sort of introduction before we get into what you correctly alluded to are the sort of food and wine journeys, the 6 white, 6 red, sparkling and dessert wine journeys that we go on in the book. But the initial part of the work is a setup, which is to say we talk a little bit in the book about, you know, how to taste wine, then how to taste wine with food, how to taste food with wine, and how to cook for wine. So it really is as much a primer on getting your sort of creative juices and thinking and approach outlined before we actually go in and talk about the various different grapes. And it was really important to me, and one of the things that's driven me historically insane about so many of the works that are out there on the subject is that, you know, a book will come out or a magazine article will come out and say, you know, goes great with Syrah. Well, that's fine, except that, you know, Syrah, like cheese, there isn't just one kind. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of different styles. And what I really wanted to do was break the wine down by style to sort of say, you know, that what works with a sort of jammy, brambly, you know, succulent Australian Shiraz is not necessarily the same kind of food that's going to work with something that's a little bit more peppery, gamey, and austere coming out of the Rhone Valley, and really spending some time there. But I hope, and it sounds at least with you two that we hit our mark, that what people do is look at this as much as sort of an empowering sink as they do, you must do this particular food with this particular wine, although there is some, you know, some good thinking and architecture behind those matches.
Well, you know, I think what's nice is you often get a book that's theory, and you say, okay, well, that's a great concept, but how do I actually put it together? Mm-hmm. Or you get a book that gives you the recipes, but it doesn't give you the theory behind it. This sort of gives you the theory and then lets you go practice.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. And I think, you know, being an educator, a career educator at heart, that was really my spot on premise, was to sort of connect the dots for people and give them the theory, but then take them into the world of practical application. And in doing so, give them a lot of options. So one of the things that, you know, was critical as I was working with my mom to put the recipes together was ensuring that the recipes themselves were approachable, the types of foods that people would want to cook and want to eat, and it reflected the American table today, so that, you know, while there's a lot of, you know, clearly Mediterranean-influenced dishes, which are what my mom is probably best known for.
Evan, we're going to have to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment after the commercial. Our guest is Evan Goldstein. His book is Perfect Pairings, A Master Sommelier's Practical Advice for Partnering Wine with Food. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagut and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or catherinelombardi.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Master Sommelier Evan Goldstein, who's written a wonderful book called Perfect Pairings, a Master Sommelier's Practical Advice for Partnering Wine with Food. Now, Evan, we talked about a number of the different books that were out there, and some of the empowering books were, you know, it started with a great book, which was, you know, Red Wine with Fish, which said, you know, you don't have to go by the old standard, you know, rigid wine pairings. And then maybe it went a little too far to say, you know, if you want to pair whatever you want with whatever you want, it doesn't matter. Well, that's not really true either.
It matters a little.
But, I mean, you ever go out and you're at a restaurant and you see just abominable wine pairings that you think,
We talked about one of these last week.
I was passing by a restaurant in my area, and they had a tasting menu out there. And it was just an abominable wine pairing tasting menu. Obviously, nobody knows what they're doing there. The one course was a pappardelle con tartufa, a truffled pasta, and the pairing was white Zinfandel.
Oh, ouch. That's painful.
But do you find that people are sort of in their enthusiasm to get involved in this wine pairing thing, that sometimes you go places and people just get it dead wrong?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, what you find is that it happens a lot at winemaker dinners and things like that, where what you'll do is you'll spend all of this time working hard with a chef. And it's, you know, I understand where they're coming from. They're proud of what they're doing. They want to be experimental. So you get to the restaurant and you'll be sitting down and working your way through the meal. And then the dish will come out and the dish will have like three or four things that you never talked about on the dish, and things that unfortunately at times can, you know, heroically just explode a pairing and make it not work. So, you know, yeah, it happens all the time, and I think it's really because people are trying at times too hard to try and show off that sort of fine space of creativity and maverick intensity while trying to make a food and wine match work, and often the results don't work that way.
Yeah, it's funny when you say that. One of the things that Francis and I always do with our chef the day of a winemaker dinner is we taste everything, because all of a sudden he'll come in and be like, oh, I got these beautiful chive blossoms, and I garnished this great dish with it. How's it going with your Sauvignon Blanc?
And it's making it taste terrible.
Yeah, no, I visited dinner last week when literally on a four-course menu, each and every course had something in it that we had never talked about.
We'll be back right after the news talking more about pairing wine and food with Evan Goldstein, Master Sommelier. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Today, our guest is Evan Goldstein. He is a master sommelier. He teaches professionals and consumers about wine and food, is the author of several books, and his newest book is Perfect Pairings, a Master Sommelier's Practical Advice for Pairing Wine with Food.
So, Evan, before the news, I told you a story about our chef adding a little chive blossom to a dish, and actually it was an oaky Chardonnay that he was trying to match and messed up our dish at the last minute. And you were talking about a wine dinner that you went to where similar types of things happened.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just so oftentimes it's the zeal of the chef and the unexpected split finger or curveball that you get when the dish actually gets in front of you. I mean, we were doing a dinner where we were actually pairing six vintages over a 25-year retrospective of different Cabernet blends. So it was an all-red wine dinner. So when you sit down and work with the chef and sort of explain, you know, we don't want to do a salad with the first course, mm-hmm. it's not going to work well with the red wine, et cetera,
right.
And we put this whole thing together, and lo and behold, as the first dish came out and we'd come to this agreement there was going to be no salad on it, that the entire appetizer was sitting on a bed of balsamic vinaigrette.
Oh, so about to say, with the beautiful vinegar.
Yes, absolutely. It was just delightful.
Let's just explain to the people out there that there are certain things that while they can sometimes match with wine, you need to be very, very careful. What are some of the landmines? The landmines are onions, raw onions. So Mark alluded to chive blossoms. Evan, you alluded to vinegar is very dangerous with wines. What are some other real hand grenades people should watch out for?
Most definitely. Probably, sticking to the world of greens and veggies for a minute, probably two of the most time-honored, most difficult matches in the world are artichokes and asparagus, the two with the two double A's, in the sense that artichokes have this characteristic or this component to them called cinarin, which, of course, the Italians make that wonderful beverage chinar from. But what it does with wine is it sort of goes in and just sort of eviscerates them. So you really – it makes almost all wines taste a little bit sweet, and if they're – it's a and it just sort of wreaks havoc. So I have a tendency to downplay – artichokes and not necessarily ever serve them as sort of a primary ingredient, but rather mix them up and melange them, maybe tossed with some potatoes and confit onions, or throw them as a part of a composed salad or something like that, but take the onus off of it. Best wines to work with them tend to be either super duper tart acidic whites, because no matter what the artichoke does to it, the wine will be fine, or sort of big bruiser red. So again, even when the artichoke goes in there, it won't hurt the wine too much.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember, if you watched the show Top Chef, but we had a couple of people from the show on, and in the finals they were doing a wine dinner. And the woman chose to do an artichoke course.
And we were sitting
during the finals, and Francis and I were watching together going, no, no.
We were actually watching Top Chef because we had Calicchio on the show the next day, and who was the chef on Top Chef. And we're sitting around with a bunch of wine people, food and wine people, watching the show, and she did artichokes with her final course. And we're like, no, oh, my God. It's funny.
Unbelievable how those things work. Well, asparagus is similar, obviously not for the same reasons, but it's a very, very strong flavored ingredient to work with, and whether you sauce it or again take the onus off of it, but working with sort of a bright sharp white or a sort of leafy green red, so Sauvignon Blanc on the white side or Cabernet Franc type wine on the red side tend to be the best ways to work that. And then eggs are always difficult too, and they tend to be difficult. So again, trying to make your frittata or quiche or whatever it is that you're serving less eggy and more other ingredient wise will generally make it more wine friendly.
I think one of the ways that this book can be used that I think is really great, and I think we may be getting a little egg heady for some of our audience, but that's we're three wine eggheads right here talking. But the idea, when it comes right down to it, I mean, this is to give you some guidelines. And what I like about having the recipes here is it gives you a little bit of theory. But basically, I mean, when people buy wine from us to take home and have a dinner party, I always say to people, look, if you're a great sommelier and a four-star chef and you're putting together a dinner that's a progression of tastes and flavors, that's one thing. And you're a professional and you've got to try and you've got a whole cellar full of stuff and a whole staff full of people and a lot of experience with those wines. What I recommend people do at home, and I want to know if you feel similarly, if you're going to have four or five wines during the course of the evening, you have a bunch of people open, pop them all and just try them. I mean, like, make the food and try it, and if it tastes good, you've got a winner, and if it doesn't, so what?
I think that can be really fun to taste, three or four different wines with the same course and see
doesn't it just come down to what people like?
Oh, at the end of the day, it's absolutely what people like. I mean, we talk about wine being, subjective, and, the best wines are the wines that you like, and certainly people have myriad opinions on food, so if you put the two of them together, it's exponentially subjective, and I absolutely agree. I mean, in fact, I was chatting with somebody the other day, and we were doing a long lead story on, what wine to have at Thanksgiving time with holiday foods, and what I was saying is, we could go, obviously you could talk about going this way or going that way, but what I actually recommended was, I said, best thing to do is, you've got a large group of people together oftentimes at the holidays, what a great excuse to pull out a number of different bottles of different wines, mix and match, see what people enjoy. And it's as much and frankly as educational for a person, regardless of whether they're professional or not, to find something that you don't like so you won't do it again as much as it is to find something that gives you pleasure.
Well, no, that brings me to another topic. Now you're, you know, just so people know, there are Master Sommelier is one of the two main degrees that you can get, Master Sommelier and Master of Wine, and there aren't that many. We've actually had 4 or 5 Master Sommeliers on the program. That's about half of them that are in the country.
We're a small group, but that is correct.
So you spend a lot of time. Write for the industry. You write for a couple of industry publications. We read your column.
Thank you.
But you teach consumers, and you also teach for the industry. Do you find that you, when you talk about wine and food and putting wine and food together, that you teach differently for people who are doing this for a living than you do for people at home who are enthusiasts?
You'll get degrees of folks on both sides. You know, from the trade side, you can be sitting there teaching a room of, you know, people who are at their level 2 Master Sommelier credentialed study, and you're talking at one level, whereas you get, you know, the server that works for Olive Garden or Cheesecake Factory, and you're dealing clearly with a level of wine sophistication that's different. So you'll change your approach and your medium very, very differently. That would be true as consumers, too. I mean, one of the things that I'll find is that you get some fairly fanatical consumers out there. They know far more about wine and oftentimes wine and food than the people that are actually serving them and making their dinner. And that is one conversation, whereas obviously novice consumers is a whole nother one. But I think that the thing that's really interesting about that question is I'll find that the people who purely enjoy wine, which is to say the consumer who drinks it, who has no, you know, vested interest in it whatsoever, frankly enjoys it a lot more than oftentimes people in the trade who are looking at it either for a professional reason, to make money, to one up their compadre over there, and have sort of lost the naive, youthful pleasure of what wine and food is all about, which is simply making life better and enjoying things more. Whereas consumers, you know, that's what it's all about for them.
Well, I think one of the things that a lot of people just are disregarding in our industry is that a lot of wines go with a lot of foods, and that we can make some pretty good matches by pairing certain wines with certain foods, and it may not be as difficult as people think it is. Now, those magical perfect matches that happen every just once in a while, you know, that's a different thing. But as far as pairing wine and food, I think that it's not as hard as people think it is.
I think at the end of the day, most people, frankly, have fairly good common sense in what they're looking for, you know, when they go out to eat or when they ask an expert online or whatever, is they're essentially just looking for validation. You know, they want permission. You know, most people do not, in spite of what I said earlier, try and pair, you know, late harvest sauterne with hamburgers. Most of them sort of say, you know, I'm thinking of having this kind of, you know, wild mushroom risotto. I was thinking about having XYZ wine here. Does it basically work? And more often than not, the answer is yeah, you know, and particularly because it's subjective. So I do believe that we can get way too heavy about the subject.
Actually, Evan, let's get a little heavy. Let's get ourselves a little heavy on the subject in just a moment. We need to take a quick break for a commercial. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500. Hey everyone, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. Our guest today is Evan Goldstein. His book is Perfect Pairings, A Master Sommelier's Practical Advice to Partnering Wine with Food. And you can find out more about that book on our website. It's a great book. I suggest you pick it up. It's chock full of recipes and some general wine. And the wine suggestions are general and enduring. And he talks about wines that are widely available. It's a great jumping off point. And the recipes are really good. So how did you decide, Evan, to work with your mom and cooking and your mom coming up with recipes?
Evan, I can't make a could do a cookbook with my mom because my mom's always right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm actually blessed. My mother is a prolific and well-known chef based out of San Francisco, and herself has penned well over 30 books and operated a very successful restaurant in the Bay Area, Square One, for many, many years. I've participated and worked with her on a number of her books that she's done, writing, you know, the wine recommendations and wine thinking and philosophy for them over the years. And it sort of seemed as I came down to putting this book together that I wanted to work with a chef who, number one, really cared about wine, and had a personal interest and passion in it, as well as understanding that it was just part of, you know, the daily livelihood of the trade. But also, you know, it's great to work with a chef who, when you're sitting here saying, you know, I wanted to work backwards. So rather than your standard cookbook, which sort of tips the hat to wine and the recipe is already sort of locked and loaded, and then you've got to go in and look at it and say, okay, what wine is going to best work with it? This was sort of the Sadie Hawkins approach. So it was kind of more, here's the wine and here's the wine style within that. What I am looking for here is a recipe which tackles the dish based on either these ingredients, these ways of preparing the ingredients, or whatever, these sorts of flavor nuances. What could we do?
And, Central Jersey, 1450. Oh. The world according to Judith. Weekdays at 2.
On this 4th of July weekend.
Sorry about that, Evan.
Oh,
you were saying?
I was just saying, and because of that, you know, and because of the fact that, you know, we've grown up together, I've grown up with her, and we know each other's palate so well, you know, she would come back and say, well, how about this, how about that? We'd play with them, we'd try them together, and very much like you were saying earlier, it's essential that you actually try the dishes first to make sure they work before pontificating about them. It was great. So I kept it in the family, which is always nice, but it also allowed me to work with a chef whose palate I know well, and for her to work with a wine person whose palate she knew equally well.
You know, which brings me to another topic. I mean, being a master sommelier and working in the industry all around, you've spoken about putting together wine dinners and finding surprises. And we actually have a rep because we've been doing wine dinners for about 14 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And our reputation is pretty good with being sensitive about putting the food and the wine together, because all of our wine dinners, if you have a winemaker in, you do the food around the wine, which is the reverse.
But the key to that is you got to be willing to change on the fly if something changes.
You got to taste the food with the wine that afternoon and say, oh, my God, get those chives out of there.
Yeah, well, and I think anybody who people who are into the wine, I mean, one of the basic premises of the book is that it's very hard for the food and wine to both be sort of the lead actor or actress at the same time. And if I'm cooking a meal and I have a very special bottle of wine, I'll sort of design what I'm doing around creating a more simple approach so that the food gives the wine the stage to show off on. By the same token, if I've found a new recipe or a book or something I'm really excited about preparing a dish, then I'll try and pick a wine that's a little bit more subdued so that I can really enjoy the nuances of the dish. It's very hard to do that. And when you're doing these wine dinners, you know, again, I as a person in the business, I appreciate what you say, because, you know, you have to say the wine is the star tonight. They're trying to do this. I need to taste this wine. I need to go back, look at what I'm doing, taste the dish. And to your point, be ready to spin on a dime there if you find that there's something implicit in the dish that is not working with the wine, to allow the wine, and in this case the winemaker, to really enjoy the wine light that the wine dinner is supposed to be giving them.
And I think that's good advice. We have a lot of industry folks who listen to the show through the computer and also in the broadcast area. And if you're a wine, if you are a restaurateur and you like to do these wine dinners, they're great. They build a lot of goodwill. They bring your customers in. They're a reason to email or to mail your customers. But when they come, you've got to get them right, and you've got to take. I mean, do you have any advice to give restaurateurs, because you do these things all the time with other restaurateurs?
Most definitely. Number one, establish your dialogue really early, so don't leave things to the last minute. You know, which is literally, it could be as straightforward as making sure you get the wines in ahead of time, that they've been prepped and stored and correctly and all that. Number two, make sure that you've worked your menus ahead of time. Go back and forth with the winemaker or winery representative to agree on what's going to be served as far as dishes go. So there are, to your point, no surprises. I strongly advocate, as you have too, that you actually do get bottles of the wine ahead of time and work and try the wines and foods together. I mean, clearly, if you're doing an old classified Bordeaux dinner, it'll be hard to get somebody to part with a bottle of, say, you know, 59 Latour. But nevertheless, most of these dinners tend to be current releases and things like that, and most wineries won't have any issue of getting you a bottle ahead of time to ensure that you're able to, you know, prepare the dish, taste the wine with it, make your tweaks appropriately, and go from there.
And even if you can't get it well in advance like that, what we often do, if there are rare bottles, and we usually have, you know, there's one old vintage or one mm-hmm. something that you can't get more of, the afternoon of the dinner. Cook
yeah.
off one of those dishes,
mm-hmm.
open the bottle in advance, you should probably be decanting it anyway,
absolutely.
And try an ounce of it with the dish. And
absolutely,
it,
absolutely.
Because we've been doing this for 20 years. I'm sure that you do as well, because you've been doing it since before 87.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you still get surprised sometimes where you're like, oh, no, that doesn't work?
I am constantly surprised. I mean, wine, that's one of the things I love so much about wine is it's humbling to you, and the wines themselves change in the bottle. Every year is a new vintage. Dishes and chefs become infinitely more creative over time. So, you know, as big as the iceberg is on the top of the surface of the water, it's bigger underneath.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, Evan, I want to thank you for coming on the show with us. It's been swell to have you.
It was a treat to be here, and it's so wonderful to chat with people who are so clearly passionate as well as knowledgeable about the subject.
Well, passionate, yes.
Thanks a lot, Evan. The book is Perfect Pairings, A Master Sommelier's Practical Advice for Partnering Wine with Food. It's by Evan Goldstein. He was the nation's eighth American Master Sommelier in 1987, and when he became Master Sommelier, he was the youngest person to achieve that esteemed title. We'll put that up on our website. We suggest you pick it up. It's a terrific book. It's also a cookbook. It's got plenty of recipes. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick. Our guest today was Evan Goldstein. That's a great book. Evan Goldstein with his mother, Joyce, puts together a wine and food book to teach you about wine.
Well, we only touched on it for a second, but his mother, Joyce, is a pretty famous chef in her own right. And she really, added a lot to the book, I think, by taking the chef side of the program.
But I think that pairing wine and food is, in a way, it's one of the most complex issues you can deal with, and in a way, it comes down to your personal taste at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what it's really all about. There are a couple of wines that people often ignore that I want to mention. Sorry mm-hmm. for my sniffle. That he touches on in this book. He touches on sparkling wine, and in this country, sparkling wine is very underappreciated.
It seems like it's been lost as far as even on tasting menus anywhere. I mean, I always try and put a sparkling wine into the tasting menu when I'm pairing wines for our tasting menu, because I just think that it's a great wine that goes great with so many of the foods.
You know that I collect antique cookbooks and antique books about food and wine mm-hmm. and stuff like that. There's a great old Esquire cookbook from 1961, and in it it's the Bachelor's Cookbook. And it has all these, mod 60s images, and it gives advice for the bachelor, like things you must have.
Like a little chair shaped like a hand?
Yeah, exactly. But it's the things that a bachelor must have, and one of the things you must have, according to it, is a can of cream of mushroom soup, so you can put it on your chicken.
Oh, yeah. Got to put it in your chicken, toss it in.
Whatever. But one of the things it says in advice is a gentleman always has a chilled bottle of champagne. Just in case. Wink, wink. And I'm like, what do you mean just in case? I have once a week I crack a bottle.
But sparkling wine, there are so many great foods, and Francis and I were just touching on this, that go with sparkling wine. Sparkling wine will cut through something that's got a butter sauce on it. Sparkling wine will cut through shellfish.
Great. You're christening a ship
with scallops. Quiet, I'm talking. but there are a lot of great foods and a lot of great ways that you can use sparkling wine, and there are a lot of different types of sparkling wine as well. And they can be really, really delicious in a tasting menu.
And champagne. Love champagne in the summertime, sitting around. It's just gorgeous. Chilled bottle of champagne, perfect. And
champagne's one of those drinks that makes in a party.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, when you go to a restaurant, I always ask if they've got a nice sparkling wine available by the glass. I think that's mm-hmm. a fabulous way to start the dinner. It mm-hmm. just sets the mood completely.
Or a half bottle is just, it's yeah. two and a half glasses.
Yeah, I'm all over that. I'm all over that. Anyway, so the book we recommend highly, Perfect Pairings, Master Sommelier's Practical Advice to Partnering Wine with Food. It's not too simple, but it really covers the topic in depth, and it gives you some practical ideas to how to put wine and food together, which is one of the most asked questions we find in among consumers. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.